A different way to think about healthcare. When discussing ways to improve healthcare, experts often focus on access to care or the cost of that care. But what if instead of thinking about individual care, healthcare providers instead focused on the overall health of the community at large? I'm Erwin Gratz, and today on Maine Calling, we'll learn about population health improvement, which seeks to assess health from a population perspective rather than a patient perspective. It may seem like a subtle difference, but proponents argue such an approach offers a better opportunity for understanding and improving overall health. In fact, they claim such an approach can help address such persistent problems as obesity, diabetes, food security, behavioral health, and drug addiction. Maine Calling explores the possibility population health improvement offers for helping communities lead healthier lives. But first, this news update. And from Maine Public Radio, I'm Erwin Gratz. This is Maine Calling. Advances in modern medicine over the past few generations have been nothing short of miraculous. Diseases that once killed millions have now been eradicated. Cancers that once meant certain death are now treatable. But despite such medical marvels, certain health issues remain difficult to address. Think obesity, diabetes, drug addiction. Today we're going to discuss population health improvement, a new way to look at the health status of a community. With me here in the studio, Ron Deprez. He's president of the Public Health Research Institute and an associate research professor at the University of New England. Barbara Leonard is president and chief executive officer of the Maine Health Access Foundation. Dr. Michael Duffy is primary care medical director for Mercy Hospital. As always, we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on improving health care, not just individuals, but entire segments of society? What's holding us back from better health for all? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you. Ron Deprez, how did we do in kind of defining this term population health?
Well, we defined it in different ways, and there's no real one definition. That's why we wrote this initial article on population health, to sort of define it, what it is, and really looking at it from two perspectives. One is it trying to understand the characteristics of a population which we can call healthy and those that are not healthy, so that we can understand where we need to go. And so it's as a noun, but it's also as an adjective, in terms of we see that population health improvement is really a process. It's a complicated process, but it's a process that we need to go through, and we need to understand how to do that better if we're going to improve population health.
Now, I think we all have an idea of what doctors do for us as patients to help us be well. What is it that physicians can't accomplish on their own?
Well, physicians are trained to treat health conditions, whether it be hypertension, diabetes, or other kinds of conditions. They're trained to recognize health problems, do good diagnoses, and do good prescriptions. Treatment plans for their patients. But that's what we call, in my area, patient health. It's very important. You need to do it. We've improved markedly, as you mentioned in your initial comments, over the years. We've seen in Maine, and we've seen across the country, we've had the opportunity to work all across the country, and we see marvels in improvement of quality of care. And in terms of, and we measure that, whether it's an A1C measure for a person with diabetes. So we're doing a better job at that. But we still see high levels of obesity, high levels of diabetes and prediabetes, hypertension's gone up, some of which is because of the longer living people who live longer and have conditions, but some of which has to do with the health conditions and the underlying factors that drive those conditions, and that's what we need to address. We're not going to change the infrastructure of the income of population briefly, but we can understand what the problems are in a community and address those problems. And they're all different, and they're all different ways, addressed different ways. But you can learn from each other, but you can address obesity issues or health, food issues in populations or in communities. But it's going to take a community to do it, which includes government, it includes the private sector, and partnerships. And we've seen this happen. We've seen it happen in Maine. We happen to be working with Healthy Acadia a lot over the last several years, and with the Wabanaki Public Health Program there, working in Alaska, doing the same kind of thing, who are addressing physical activity issues, addressing PTSD with veterans. And they're doing it with a community perspective and understanding who can bring what to the table and what they need to do, and then get resources. The problem is resources, but I'll stop there.
Okay. Let's bring Barbara Leonard into this conversation. Barbara, tell me a little bit more about the Maine Health Access Foundation and where it fits in this.
Sure. The Maine Health Access Foundation was founded in 2000, and we've been making grants in Maine since 2002 to promote access to quality health care, especially for folks who are uninsured and underserved, and improve the health of everyone in Maine. And we are dedicated to all of those aspects of our work. So in many ways, I think I am sort of between Ron and Mike in the kinds of things that we do, which is we try to improve quality health care. We also try to improve health at the community level. We have a couple of different grant programs right now that work on that quite intensively. One's called Thriving in Place that focuses a lot on individuals with chronic conditions or who are aging and tries to link health care with social services, community services, both paid and voluntary services to help people stay thriving in their communities. Another grant program that has been going on for a number of years is the Healthy Community Grant Program. And that's particularly relevant here because we provided funding to communities so that they could work with all the folks in their community, even people who typically don't have the opportunity to participate, who aren't involved in local government, to find out what the most important health issues were for them, rather than us saying, you must work on obesity or you must work on blood pressure. And they are now moving into 3 years of implementation of their plans on issues ranging from access to healthy food to mental health issues, substance abuse issues, social isolation. And so what we are able to do as a foundation is provide funding to communities and to healthcare organizations to do the kind of work that actually has the possibility of making health better for people in Maine.
Dr. Duffy, you say hospitals also have a role in this beyond that doctor-patient relationship. Talk about that.
Well, more because of that doctor-patient relationship, I would say. I see that every day, and I've been doing this for 17 years. The value and the power of that patient-provider relationship can't be understated. And we can make use of that relationship when we screen for some of these issues that Barbara just mentioned, and when we pair with the community resources that Ron mentions. What I've seen in my career path is a bit of an evolution in primary care, where there's been an increased emphasis on wellness and preventative health. Yes, we treat chronic medical issues, but we also screen for all of the issues that can affect the wellness of our populations, and it's on us to connect the patients who look to us as the authority when it comes to health issues, to connect that patient with the best care. And sometimes that best care is a community resource.
Hmm. Ron, we haven't mentioned yet, but you are the author of an article in the current Maine Policy Review that talks about this. And one of the things that you mention in that article is creating an asset map. What would be on that map?
Well, it depends on the issue, but if you were addressing, say, obesity, what would you have in the community for activity patterns at activity levels or programs at schools, what people, how to get there, are there walking paths, is the environment conducive, do workplaces allow their, have places at gyms or have an opportunity for people to walk or any kind of activity to are there food places to buy food where you can get healthy foods, know how to cook healthy foods, all that would be part of an asset map for addressing weight and physical activity, say. But a different issue would be a different asset, Matt.
All right. I'm curious to ask our other two guests. Talk to me about your relationship to that asset map. Barbara, do the grants help generate the places on that map, if you will, or connect people to them?
What I will say is that our individual grantees often will go through the process of developing asset maps that relate to the issues that they are trying to work on in their communities. So they will bring a very diverse group of people together in their community and identify, okay, for our community, if we're trying to address this problem, what are the assets that we have that either help us from feeling that problem quite so severely or that can help us to actually improve it? So I think access to healthy food is a really good example. In Waterville, they're thinking about that issue. They're understanding more about each of the places that provide low-cost food. So there are multiple organizations that volunteer in the community to provide low-cost or no-cost food. They're doing a better job connecting with the grocery stores in the community so that the food that's donated is donated in ways that are useful to those who are seeking the food. And I think the key piece of what they're doing is that they have community members who sometimes use these resources, giving them input onto what they need and want and how it's best to provide that. And I think that's a really critical element to success.
Okay. Michael Duffy?
Well, Mercy is uniquely positioned with regards to community medicine, even defines itself as a community hospital with a primary emphasis on primary care and community health. And so Mercy has a lot of ties to community resources and has a mission department we rely on every day to help connect our patients with those resources in the community. We've developed a team-based model in primary care where we actually have team members primarily charged with that idea of helping connect a patient and a resource. These care coordinators do just that. It's a complex job to find those resources, to find who's accepting patients, of what insurance status. There's a lot of different hurdles to navigate sometimes, so it does take a team.
Let me get back to but what we're missing here, Erwin, is that a lot we talk about asset maps and looking at resources, but the bigger problem is that most communities don't have sufficient resources. Mm-hmm. And as we build communities or as we look at communities, they aren't walking past the schools. There's no infrastructure that will promote health or promote a change of culture in the population. And one of the assets I want to be very clear about is leadership. You need leadership to make change, whether it's in a company or a community. And so, and that's where physicians can play a big role if they would like to, because they're seen as leaders. But there's also community leaders who have to be part of that, whether they be part of a poverty program or whatever they are. They have to come forth and lead this issue. That's what we see. We see the most successful networks for change are those where there's designated or demonstrated leadership to understand what we have and we don't have, analyze the data, come up with the issue, and move it forward.
Let me ask you this question. Is there a role for individuals in this? I mean, are there questions we, as individuals, as potential patients, need to be asking, things we need to be advocating for, that in the end would make us as individuals and everybody else in our community healthier?
Absolutely. And in any kind of coalition that we put together that we see that works well, you have regular, quote-unquote, regular citizens who come forth who have these problems and can tell it through their eyes. What's the issue may not be obesity. The issue be I don't have any money to buy good food or I can't buy good food. Mm-hmm. We don't know that. We just see the obesity rates. It doesn't tell us what the problem is. You need to get behind the data and look at what the problem is from the point of view of people who are there living in that community.
Yeah. Barbara, I mean, do some of the grants you have involve public input for this? Absolutely.
And that, I think, is one of the pieces that's so powerful about both of these programs that I mentioned, Thriving in Place and Healthy Community Grants. And what we've found in some of those communities where individuals are involved in trying to identify issues and then shape solutions is that they then become community leaders in their own right. And they begin to see that they can bring friends and family along in helping to make changes in their communities. So I think what we're saying, all of us, is that the work that we need to do to help people in Maine and in the country be healthier is not one by one or two by two. It's community by community, and the healthcare system is such an important part of the community that that linkage between healthcare and community efforts is critical. So it's a group effort.
I couldn't agree with that more. Clinically, there is nothing more satisfying than a successful lifestyle intervention and seeing that permeate a group, a family, a group of employees. It spreads. That's an incredibly rewarding thing to experience.
That's Dr. Michael Duffy of Mercy Hospital, one of our guests here today. We've got a few more things to talk about this. We have at least one caller on the line so far, and we will have more coming, I'm sure. So do stay with us. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, more of our discussion and your calls and comments.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the UMaine New Writing Series, sponsor of Maine Public's Poems from Here, heard Fridays on Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical. And Simply Sized Home, downsizing and moving management specialists serving southern and mid-coast Maine. Learn more at simplysizedhome.com.
In 1923, the wealthiest people per capita in the world were the Osage Indian tribe in Oklahoma, thanks to oil deposits on their land. On the next Fresh Air, David Grand talks about the serial murders that followed as local whites targeted the Osage for their money.
Here was a population being systematically murdered one by one.
His new book is Killers of the Flower Moon. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Television has four channels. In addition to our main channel, we also offer World and Create and our new PBS Kids channel. World explores our world through many of your favorite programs, such as the NewsHour and Nova, and at different, perhaps more convenient times of the day. Create is our how-to channel, from cooking to carpentry to travel and then some. And the new PBS Kids is 24/7 educational safe kids programming with a companion streaming service with videos and games for your mobile device. If you'd like more information about World, Create, or PBS Kids, including how to find them, see your experience member guide, visit mainepublic.org and click on television, or call Maine Public Audience Services.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Erwin Gratz. Today on the program, Understanding Population Health Improvement. With me here in the studio, Ron Duprez, who is the president of the Public Health Research Institute and an associate research professor at the University of New England, Barbara Leonard, who is president and chief executive officer of the Maine Health Access Foundation, Dr. Michael Duffy, is primary care medical director for Mercy Hospital. We invite you to join our conversation. The phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. So let's go on the line. This is Gregor in Bangor. Gregor, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there. Thank you very much for taking my call. My name is Gregor Durupe. I'm a pharmacist at Penobscot Community Healthcare here in Bangor, Maine. And I have 2 points that I'd really like to talk in regarding to population health. One is technology. I mean, really, technology has really helped shape the way for us to look at population health. I know at PCHC, we have a health analytics tool that really looks at all of our primary care doctors, all of their patients, and really sees the metrics for particular patient populations, not just, you know, one particular patient. And it's really helped us to really track how are diabetes patients doing with their A1C as a whole and not just that particular patient themselves. The second point that I'd like to really talk into is the interdisciplinary work that goes along with population health, and some of the guests today have talked about that. And at PCHC, we actually have a couple of different initiatives that's really helped and gone a long way in regards to population health. One is our CSI, our Controlled Substances Initiative Group, which takes a bunch of different providers. So MDs, DOs, NPs, social workers, pharmacists, all in a round table looking at particular patients that are on very, very high opioid MMEs or morphine equivalents. So we work all together to really try to see how we can do better with our opioid population at PCHC. We also have another group called High Utilization Group, and it's almost the same concept. We're looking at very, very high utilizer patients who go to the ER because, you know, perhaps their care isn't as robust as we'd like to see it. And the main thing that we see is that there's great success in bringing in very people of different disciplines. I mean, a lot of the patients that I see, you know, before we can even get to their diabetes or we get to their hypertension, a lot of the things that really block and have barriers in their health are non-medical things like, you know, financial issues, you know, social issues.
I'm going to stop you there for just a second. I want to get a comment. Ron, this does sound like a piece of what it is you're talking about.
It is a piece, but it's called patient care. It's patient care with populations that have conditions. It's a small part of what we're talking about. It's important. I think the last thing that Gregor was talking about, you know, figuring out why people are showing up at the ER, it's a non-medical issue and how to get resources and connect people who need non-medical resources to get healthier.
Okay. Gregor, thank you very much for the call. I want to move on to our next caller. This is Frank in Brunswick. Frank, good afternoon.
Hi.
You're on Maine Calling.
Oh, thank you very much. I used to do population health studies primarily in the drug and alcohol field, so I would always look at it as an outsider, not somebody from the inside. However, last July, I broke my leg coming back from a hike, and it started me an entire journey inside the healthcare system. And I think some of the assumptions that people make is that, for example, you don't want people to use ER. You have no choice. The second thing, I mean, I wound up going to Midcoast, and then eventually my doc at Midcoast said, you got to go down to Maine Med. And then three operations later at Maine Med, and 6 months later, the leg is sort of almost healed now. It was a very complex fracture. So you've got that fact. The second thing is that a lot of people who get inside the system develop secondary symptoms from being just hospitalized or institutionalized. I mean, I got a bladder infection, which I didn't expect to get. So you've got this. And the third thing is that essentially you've got a bias towards institutionalization. And I really had it. We had a three-hour meeting to try to get me discharged to a home. And if I didn't get the discharge, I would have been cut off of Medicare. So there are things like that. And I think the complexity of the healthcare system with all the specialists that you see and how you go back and forth between specialists, just the transports alone, are a factor that people take. And you cannot make a rational decision when you're laying on your back, you know, in a hospital with your leg hanging off. So this thing about, you almost need a patient advocate. You need someone to take your hand and say, okay, now we're going to go to the urologist, and then we're going to go over here and see the orthopedist, and then you're going to go over here and do this, and then we're going to go to the inpatient rehab center, and you're going to be seeing So that kind of thing is a guide, a mentor, almost like a seeing eye dog to get yourself through the system, and it is
right.
Quite complex.
Let me ask Dr. Duffy. I mean, it does what he's saying, but the patient advocate, of course, is good advice. But beyond that, it kind of does point to the question that perhaps a piece of this too is figuring out how to get people through and out of the healthcare system more quickly than has been true in the past?
Well, yes, when appropriate. And that resource that I think is being described really should exist, as I see it, within the primary care environment. You know, we have a team of people that we've developed that can facilitate that through a coordinated effort to navigate the patient through to the best outcome. The outcome is the goal, the quality outcome. What resources are used along the way, it does become incredibly complex.
Hmm. All right, Frank, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Steve in Orono. Steve, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Good afternoon. I just want to – there was a study done, I think it was 2009, wasn't it, by Harvard Medical and Cambridge Health Alliance, and I think President Obama used that when we're trying to create the ACA, that working age Americans have a 40% higher risk of death than privately insured counterparts, people who have access. So I wonder if that has been updated. And that was 23% higher than it was in 1993. So aren't we really talking about two? There are people who have access and people who don't have access, and there are people dying because they don't have access, and that also creates an imperfect medical situation, whether it's in, certainly at a hospital, acute hospital, because the resources are not really allocated. We're trying to react to people who end up in the emergency rooms, and they're sicker, and they have more complications, and they go to school, and they work. You know, these are working people, so they just create our system. You know, how do we get ahead of it? But my question is, has that been updated? Study.
Let's see if somebody's got an answer to that question. I'm not sure we do, but I'm gonna follow up nonetheless, Ron, with you to ask that the other thing that this raises, of course, is that question about access to healthcare services, whether it be doctors, hospitals. You know, I assume this too, at some level, is part of total patient health.
Access to care is obviously very important, and we know it makes a difference in health outcomes. At the same time, we're also talking about access to non-medical services like mm-hmm. walking paths, like better food. That's the area of access that we lack in this country, that other societies are doing a better job at that than we are, and that's what we need. But with the way we build communities, we don't do a good job in connecting local community resources or having local community resources that people can have so they don't get sick. The idea is prevention is not to get sick.
Right.
Once you get sick, yes, you need access to health care. We want access to health resources.
Right, right. And some of it is just under helping people make that connection. I mean, I'm not sure right off the top that a lot of government officials pondering the funding for a walking path are making the connection to making their community healthier.
Well, you know, there was a program that's still going on at USCDC. It was called the Community Transformation Grants, which Maine got about five of them. We worked on one up in Hancock County. And basically that was for the purpose of working with schools, working with farmers markets, working for food. Those are the kind of monies that should be going into population health, in our view, along with access to medical care. But they're not the same.
Okay. Barbara, I want to bring you back in because before we went on the air, you were talking about the experience in Franklin County. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Absolutely. Well, what's going on there and what's been going on there for decades is they do have a very community-wide approach to health, and it includes both public health, community-based services, and community health improvement efforts, along with the hospital in that community. And they've shown that over long periods of time, that connection between community health promotion and access to health care can really improve health status. The major focus was around cardiovascular disease prevention, and they were extraordinarily successful. And an article was published back in January of 2015 about their success. But I also want to interject a couple of things here. One is that the healthcare system can only help people get healthy if they have insurance to receive the services. And so it's a critical piece, but those who can't either get services paid for because they're uninsured or who work and can't necessarily get to primary care if there are limited hours, people who are low income have more challenges. People with mental health issues have more challenges getting to primary care. Individuals who are members of racial or ethnic minorities, we know, have barriers to receiving primary care. Those who are unemployed often are uninsured. And so we have to remember that there are many populations in Maine for whom both health care and access to community health opportunities are even more challenging. And we have to keep working on that because our health status as a state depends on our helping those who have the biggest barriers do better.
Dr. Duffy's been shaking his head a lot because obviously, I mean, hospitals will treat any patient that shows up. That's required. But it is true, is it not, that ultimately the level, the quality, the quantity of health care you can access depends on whether or not you're insured or have the financial resources to do that.
I think, unfortunately, the data would agree. I happen to work for a mission-driven organization, and we care for all populations with particular emphasis on those most at risk. So every day we're making decisions around that objective of particularly helping those populations that are going to experience the most difficulty in accessing quality care. It adds one more layer of complexity to the already incredibly complex equation of quality health care, but it also makes it worth doing.
Got a question that's come in via our Facebook page from Jim, and it's about the question of whether or not climate change might affect population health. Ron, is that something you've looked
at? It definitely will affect and is affecting population health, more so in other countries right now, but it will affect our populations as well in terms of if the lobster population gets eradicated as the warmer water comes up the Gulf of Maine, it's going to put a lot of people out of work. And it's going to affect incomes and affect education. Just a good example of what's happening with climate change in our own backyard.
I can think of another climate change health issue, the existence of Lyme disease in Maine. When I moved to my home in Winslow 10 years ago, we didn't have ticks. Yesterday, I pulled 5 ticks off my 2 dogs. And, you know, Lyme disease is highly, highly prevalent now in much of Maine.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. This is John in Wakefield. John, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling. Hello.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to pick up again on the kind of healthy lifestyle topic that you were talking about earlier and point to two examples, I think, where we could do better in Maine. One is where we locate new schools, try to keep them in town so that kids can walk to school and start them out on healthy habits. And the other is really where the medical profession, I think, needs to do a better job in locating hospitals. You know, an example is the one in Augusta, where now no one that works at that hospital can walk to it. Whereas before, I think there were a lot of folks, especially the lower wage folks, that could afford to live nearby and walk there if they had to, whether it was a snowstorm or a nice day or their kids got off early from school. It's a tough nut to crack, and we've lost a lot of our skills and observations that are required to figure out how to make living more healthier day to day, but those are some examples.
You know, it's interesting. It raises a question, Ron. I mean, is there anything inherently healthier about living in an urban environment where things are in walking distance than not?
Well, if you look at Europe, I mean, people walk everywhere because they tend to live more in cities, and they tend to be, even though they may eat fattier foods than we eat, they tend to be more healthier. Now, obviously, diet is important, but walking, bicycling, just exercise. We know physical activity, the more you do, the better it is. Mm-hmm. It's flat out proven over and over again. And so, yes, if we can build these schools so people can get to, so kids can walk to them, take their bike to them, if we can build our workplaces so that there is an incentive to exercise, whether it's going to work or whether it's at the workplace, that's very important. The data is clear on that as well.
Barbara?
I will say that from an equity standpoint, just being in an urban area may not do it for you. Asthma rates are terrible among low-income urban dwelling families. Even here in Maine, in Lewiston, the issues of lead poisoning because of some of the older housing stock are really most prevalent for people who are right downtown. And so it's lower income individuals, new Americans who are living in that housing stock and are really bearing the brunt of that lead poisoning epidemic.
Yeah, and I mean, much of the state is rural. So at the end of the day, there have to be other strategies, because many Mainers are not going to live anywhere near downtown anyplace.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Let us take another quick break. When we come back, we'll have more of your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com.
David Letterman was a fixture in our late nights for more than three decades. Author Jason Zinnemann says the key to Letterman's charm was his subversion.
At the same time, he was accessible. He seemed like a middle American, relatable guy you might know from down the street.
David Letterman, the last giant of late night and the latest on the crisis in North Korea. On this afternoon's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. And coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker is Nancy Fund, founder of DBL Partners. She'll be speaking about the world of impact investing, where success is not measured just by the single profit bottom line. That's Nancy Fund coming up on Commonwealth Club of California at 2 o'clock in just a few minutes right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Erwin Gratz. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about a different way of thinking about healthcare. In the studio with me, Dr. Michael Duffy, primary care medical director for Mercy Hospital, Ron DePrez, president of the Public Health Research Institute and an associate professor at the University of New England, and Barbara Leonard, president and chief executive of the Maine Health Access Foundation. You can still join our conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. All right, let's go back to the phones. This is Jack in Portland. Jack, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious about prescription drug prices in this country versus other first world countries, because I'm pretty sure that we pay more. And I was curious about why is it that we're still okay with drug companies advertising when I feel it only causes patients to go in demanding drugs that they don't need from doctors who are going to give them to them because they'll look until they find a doctor who will.
Okay. Dr. Duffy.
Thanks, Jack. As a practicing primary care provider, I couldn't agree with you more. This is one of the things that makes our lives more challenging. On the other hand, the financial incentives in the pharmaceutical industry is what drives innovation. And that would be the argument that if there were a pharmacy executive in the room would provide you. So there's a balance to be had there. I do think that there's plenty of room for better advertising, smarter advertising that doesn't just generate hysteria and concern, and a way that it's done in a more high quality manner that patients can understand. I think there is a lot of room to be made there, and I suspect that there'll be progress to be made in the next few years in that.
Okay. Let me go to Kathy from Brunswick. Kathy's been very patient. Good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. One of the important resources for access and prevention are nurse practitioners. There's over 1,300 of them. They're nurses in advanced practice. There's other providers, of course, also. But I just wanted to make the point that we're not only in family practices, I happen to be in women's health, but in psych and peds all over. I, for instance, practice in Lewiston and also go out to Vinyl Haven because women have limited access to women's care out there. So I'm just, you know, when we discuss access prevention, we're all over. Another good example are the family planning clinics throughout Maine, staffed by nurse practitioners. So I just wanted to raise that as other providers are also.
Okay. Kathy, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Tricia in Belfast. Tricia, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to offer two pieces of information. One is when I first got my bachelor's degree, my first employment was as a medical social worker in a hospital in Maine, and I did a lot of family meetings, which would often be educating the family members about how to care for the patients at when they were returning home, and then set up, you know, home health services and, you know, visiting nurses and things like that. So I just want to, I know when I first started working there, the average length of stay was 28 days, and you had a lot of time to do meetings and setting things up. And by the time I left that position, the average length of stay was 7 days, and they whittled down, not only, you know, the patients are in and out quicker, but less time to do that kind of collaborating that is needed. Separately, as a separate topic, I want to offer the idea, or, you know, connect the dots about individuals gardening as a non-medical, you know, community health building element. And so when people talk about, you know, not having money for good food, there are lots of people in, I'd say, every community in Maine, that there are people that know how to garden, everything from digging up a little plot in your yard to some bales of hay or container gardening. And it is a skill that many, many people know. Some people think of it as a hobby, but I, you know, definitely see it as a health-promoting aspect that could be taught.
Ron?
Let me comment on that. Yeah, absolutely, Barbara. And what's happening in many school systems is that they're showing children how to grow foods. And they're adults as well, but they're doing it in the schools. And then they're doing it in Hancock County. They're doing it in other counties. I'm sure Barbara knows about, Barbara here knows about. But and that's a very important skill set to learn, and it can be learned, and it can help in terms of generating healthier foods to eat. We all know organic foods, local foods, are going to be better for you than foods from afar.
Hmm. Barbara.
I'm not going to talk specifically about the gardening right now, but I'd like to give a couple of resources that people can check out. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a big national foundation that focuses on creating a culture of health, has worked very closely with the University of Wisconsin to develop a resource called the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps. And the County Health Rankings are one way of measuring the degree of health in counties. You may or may not agree with all of the factors that they put in there, but the roadmaps that are included give very specific ideas about what communities can do to address different health concerns, gardening in schools and in communities, other kinds of very practical things that local communities can do to improve the health of their community. And then in a nod to the importance of linking healthcare and community health, the DeBeaumont Foundation out of Maryland has something called the Practical Playbook, which talks about very practical ways in which healthcare and public health can work together to improve population health. And when I say population health, I mean everybody in the population, not just those who get healthcare, but everybody.
And let me follow up that what you're also doing when you do that is you're building community. And building community and building changing cultures is essential if you're going to improve health of populations.
Hmm. You know, Ron, in your article, you mentioned, too, that, of course, some of what we're talking about, perhaps when we talk about building walking trails in communities or sidewalks, whatever, I mean, some of this is not cheap. And perhaps from time to time, that's a barrier to progress in this regard, correct?
It's a huge barrier. We seem to have money for health care when people get sick, but we have very little money for health prevention. And until we change that, it's going to be difficult to address some of these issues.
Do we have evidence that making some of those investments pays off down the road so that ultimately it is less expensive for a community to build a walking path than to deal with the various medical expenses that will arise from people not getting enough exercise?
Well, we know that physical activity, the payoffs for that. I can't cite any studies on walking paths versus non-walking paths as far as what the effect that has. But look at, we're in Portland, Maine now, and Back Bay has a running path. That path was built about 20 years ago, and everybody poo-pooed it. And it said, no one will use it. That is the most used path in probably the state of Maine. And because people do walk, they do use it, they do run, they do take their kids there. It's a really good example of a little investment paid off a lot for a lot of people.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to the phones. This is Mark in Vienna. Mark, good afternoon. You're on Main Calling.
Thank you. Could panelists comment on the roles of preventing and healing stress and building resilience to stress as components of chronic conditions and population health, for example, through integrating primary care, mental health, and community services with children and families? Okay. Thank you.
Ron, go ahead.
I'll start off with saying, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't think stress had much to do with health. We did a study on cancer and stress about late 1980s, and there was no data. Now the data is very clear that stress is probably a more important factor than smoking or other kinds of risk factors in health, whether it's cancer, whether it's cardiovascular disease. So stress is extremely important to address. And I'll stop there. But how to address that stress is, you know, there's personal ways of doing it. There's group ways of doing it. But I'll let the other.
Stress is something that we are ever aware of in primary care these days. The health of the body and the health of the mind are intertwined. And you can't expect a patient to be physically healthy and have a good physical outcome if they're not emotionally healthy and vice versa. So we are always looking for ways to engage both the physical and the emotional. We are integrating behavioral health right now in all of our primary care offices. That's a really significant priority because so much of what we do with our focus on wellness ends up in the behavioral health realm.
Hmm. Let me just follow up with, for example, physical activity. We know physical activity relieves stress. We know healthier foods will put less burden on the body and relieve stress, physical stress.
Okay. Ron, we've been talking a lot about the resources that are beginning to be deployed to this end, but in your Maine Policy Review article, there was a sidebar talking about the Healthy Maine Partnerships. Talk to us a little bit about what has happened to them.
Well, in my view, in our view in public health, the Healthy Maine Partnerships were a tremendous stride forward to building a what we call a public health infrastructure in Maine. They're private government partnerships. They were funded in part by funds from the Healthy Maine Fund. And they put together tremendous groups of people in the private sector, whether you're talking about Hancock County, Washington County, Cumberland County. And so they were really, we felt, an important development for Maine and public health, because lots of places you go. Go to Alaska, for example. There's no public health beyond the state. And that's why there's a big challenge there. But we had these partnerships going, and they would parlay that initial money they got from government to actually get more money from different foundations, from the federal government. And so we saw them as a tremendous benefit to Maine. And you can look at the programs they've sponsored, whether it be sponsored from Maine Health Access Foundation or other groups. And we see now that they've curtailed that program. They've reorganized it. And they're now using the health districts. But I think it's a diminution of the public-private partnerships that we need in public health and health care.
Interesting. All right, let's go back to the phones. Steve is in Belfast. Steve, good afternoon. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Listening to this program, it keeps occurring to me that Maine has got the oldest population in the country, and it's getting older. And so much of what you've been talking about is kids and schools and taking care of kids and educating kids, and really it seems like the more and more the focus of medicine in Maine is going to be on geriatrics.
It's a good question. So how do we reach out to the older population, and can some of these techniques still help them be healthier? Barbara?
Absolutely. One of our grants for Thriving in Place is in Dover Foxcroft, as is one of our Healthy Community grants. And what's interesting about what's happening in that community is that the coalitions that have been working on issues related to aging and early childhood are getting together, because what they're finding is that the creation of a healthy community, access to healthy foods, access to the possibility for exercise, and improving the economic status of the community so that people are employed and people are staying in community, all tie together. And so I would say to the caller that they are the same issues, and the things that are important for kids are the things that are important for older people. And we need to think about our world that way.
Yeah. And just follow up, you know, we think about what's happening in diabetes and what we call now pre-diabetes, which has become a medical condition. It's, you know, before you have what I would call diagnosable diabetes. And we are doing a tremendous amount of work now in Maine to have educate people who have pre-diabetes so that they can reduce their weight, improve the physical activity, and not have diabetes at a later stage. And most of these are adults, either middle-aged or older adults. Few young people, but most of them are for the older population. And if you address active exercise in diabetes, you're also going to help with cardiovascular. So there is an effort going on in prevention for the older population.
I have about a minute left. Ideally, if these efforts really succeed, what will that look like? What would we see different in the health of our population?
I think you'll see a higher quality style of life among people. We're all going to die, but we don't want to die until we die. We don't want to be sick when we're dying, until the very end, perhaps.
Hmm.
I think we'll see a population that doesn't look to medical care to fix everything for it. Where medical care is right-sized, it's critically important, but it's not the first place to go.
Okay. I look forward to a more proactive and interactive healthcare experience, one in which patients are engaged to participate in their healthcare with an emphasis on wellness and prevention. I think we're heading there already. I think we're going to be making great use of technology and data going forward, which will change the face of that interaction.
Okay. He's Michael Duffy of Mercy Hospital, the primary care medical director for Mercy. I want to remind you, if you'd like to take a look at Ron DePrez's article in the current edition of the Maine Policy Review, we have a link to that at our website, mainepublic.org. Barbara, thank you as well. Our guests today, Barbara Leonard, President and Chief Executive of the Maine Health Access Foundation, Ron DePrez, President of the Public Health Research Institute, and an Associate Research Professor at the University of New England, and Dr. Duffy, as I mentioned. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's show will be broadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Keith Shortall and a conversation about a new novel. I'm Erwin Gratz. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.